Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, August 12, 2026, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza is still primarying. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at WHUS.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. So health-wise, I would say I'm doing better and better. In terms of Lyme, it's probably almost gone. I've got a week left of antibiotics, and I'm continuing to take herbs. I'm going to take the herbs for a while. I may increase doses. We'll see. I've got motherwort, which is good for the heart, and I've got cryptolepis, which is an herb that will go after a lot of co-infections, but it will go after all forms of Lyme, as well as Hotunia. And then Kudzu will also go after Lyme, but also gets into your brain and is a neuroprotective. So I'm taking those, and I'm also taking cordyceps every day. And the cordyceps and the motherwort I'm going to be taking for a long time. They're going to be part of my basic plan. But the killer herbs, the herbs that are directed at Lyme, I may take those for another couple of months. And I'm reading Bill Rawls. And Bill Rawls wrote a wonderful book on healing Lyme. And so I want to see what he has to say. And of course, one of the things he says is the best thing that you can do to treat tick-borne illness is to take care of system disruptors. So that means staying away from food intolerances, avoiding sugar, alcohol, all kinds of things that bother you, life stressors, processed food, that kind of thing, and eating really healthy, getting good exercise, getting good rest, and all of those things. Because what he talks about, the microorganisms that cause tick-borne illness as stealth microbes, that a lot of them are able to hide various places in your body, that they, and in low concentrations, they're mostly not in your blood, which is kind of why you don't see antibodies all the time in people's blood, that they can have symptoms and you don't see antibodies when you do regular labs for them, because they hide in joints, they hide in heart tissue, they hide in connective tissues. Lyme particularly, Lyme eats collagen. So anywhere there's collagen, the spirochetes burrow into it and they get out of circulation. And there are collagenous places in your body, like parts of your joints, that don't see a lot of circulation. So they're hard to get to. So movement, even if it's gentle movement, helps to bathe tissues. Even if it's not direct blood flow, you're getting interstitial fluid. And if you put antimicrobial stuff into you and you put general good nutrition into you, then you'll eventually get rid of the Lyme. And if you have a good functioning immune system, you can keep these things at bay. Bill Rawl's idea is that you always have stealth microbes on board. It's just a matter of how well your immune system is functioning to make peace with them and keep them at bay. It was a very interesting idea. So as I go through the book, I'll report more on that. Ron is stressed because he's running the primary right now, and I'm looking forward to seeing him regularly again. But at some point later in the month, we'll probably go back to making shows together, which will be nice. But his schedule frequently doesn't allow for him to make shows on Monday. So I'm making shows on other days and banking some time so I can have some time off. All right. So let's talk about some interesting stuff. Today, what I'm going to start with is coffee and your microbiome. So that's interesting. We were talking about coffee last week and how the caffeine at certain doses can be helpful for you, and it can be helpful for cardiovascular health. So this is about coffee, the microbiome, and metabolic health. There's a new study in Nature that talks about this. So it's long outgrown its reputation as a guilty pleasure. Over the last decade, there are large cohort studies that consistently link regular coffee consumption with reduced risks of type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, liver disease, neurodegeneration, and all-cause mortality. Until recently, Why coffee is so consistently protective has remained an open question. So there was a study in Nature that added pieces to the puzzle, pointing squarely at the gut microbiome and metabolome as key mediators of coffee's health effects. When combined with emerging data summarized in recent clinical reviews and expert commentaries, a more integrated story is coming into focus. Coffee is acting less like a simple stimulant and more like a complex microbiome modulating plant food. Very interesting. Here's a synthesis of the new research and how practitioners can begin to translate the findings into practical clinical guidance. So coffee is a microbiome active functional food. Who knew? So most patients think about coffee in terms of caffeine, energy, alertness, and perhaps blood pressure or sleep, yet chemically coffee is closer to a botanical extract than a single ingredient beverage. Coffee contains polyphenols, especially chlorogenic acid, diterpenes like cafestol and caweol, melanotins, which are formed during roasting, soluble fibers and oligosaccharides, and minerals and small amounts of vitamins. Many of the constituents are poorly absorbed in the upper GI and therefore reach the colon, where they become substrates and signals for the gut microbiota. That's all the good bacteria, well, all the bacteria that lives in your colon, which is where most of your immune system resides. So multiple human and in vitro studies have shown that coffee and its polyphenols can increase beneficial taxa, that's like bifidobacteria and certain butyrate producers. Butyrate is one of the chief nutrients for the microbiome in your gut. It's very good for you. It can reduce potentially pathogenic or pro-inflammatory species. It can enhance short-chain fatty acid production, which short-chain fatty acids are good for energy. And it can modulate microbial genes that are involved in bile acid metabolism and xenobiotic processing. So that means it helps you detox stuff. So when you take that together, it suggests that part of coffee's systemic impact is mediated through shifts in microbial composition and function, with downstream effects on metabolic, immune, and neuroendocrine pathways. So, key insights from the Nature paper. The paper advances the field by moving beyond simple coffee versus no coffee comparisons and instead integrating coffee intake with detailed microbiome and metabolic profiling. While the technical details vary, studies of this kind typically share several features that are particularly relevant for practitioners. So multi-omics design, instead of looking only at microbiota composition, that's your gut flora, researchers also examine microbial genes, metabolites in blood and stool, and clinical phenotypes. That allows them to connect who is there with what they're doing and how the host is responding. There's dose-response relationships. By examining gradations of coffee intakes, these analyses can identify whether moderate versus high coffee intake differentially associates with specific microbes and metabolites, which is important for giving nuanced recommendations. It links microbiome shifts to disease risk markers. Coffee-associated microbial signatures are correlated with outcomes such as insulin sensitivity, lipid profiles, inflammatory markers, liver enzyme, or cardiovascular risk scores, which hopes to move from correlation towards plausible mechanisms. Across the research, there are some themes that emerge. Coffee consumption is associated with a more diverse and functionally robust gut microbiome. Specific microbial pathways involved in polyphenol degradation, short-chain fatty acid production, and bile acid transformation are enriched in coffee drinkers. Metabolites linked to improved metabolic health, that's like higher short-chain fatty acids, more favorable bile acid profiles, and anti-inflammatory phenolic metabolites tend to track with higher coffee intake. These microbiome and metabolite patterns partially mediate the association between coffee and lower cardiometabolic risk. While we still need more interventional trials to fully confirm causality, the converging lines of evidence strongly support a microbiome-mediated contribution to coffee's health benefits. So coffee, the gut, and systemic health, there's mechanistic pathways. So it improves your barrier function and lowers endotoxemia. So short-chain fatty acids like butyrate and propionate are often increased in coffee drinkers, which support tight junction integrity. So the tight junctions, you have villi in your small intestine, you have villi, and those are the little finger-like projections that absorb food for you. And the tight junctions, help it are such that the villi are really close together, And if they get inflamed and irritated, they open up and there's space between them and there becomes irritation and openings, and there, it increases porosity of the small intestine. And that's where you get the idea of leaky gut. So because it helps those tight junction barriers, it also improves mucus production and epithelial energy metabolism. So the energy, it helps the energy of the cells that line the intestines. And a better barrier reduces translocation of lipopolysaccharides and other microbial products into circulation, which lowers metabolic endotoxemia and chronic low-grade inflammation. Then there's modulation of bile acid signaling. Gut bacteria convert primary bile acids into secondary bile acids, which in turn signal through receptors such as FXR and TGR5 that regulate glucose and lipid metabolism, GLP-1 secretion, and energy expenditure. Coffee-driven shifts in microbial bile acid metabolism may help explain its links to improved glycemic control and lower non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and NASH risk, which is now known as MASLD, metabolic associated, it's changed the acronym, and it stands for something a little bit different. It's not just non-alcoholic. It's just a metabolic issue that gives you fatty liver. So polyphenol-driven metabolites, microbial mechanism of coffee polyphenols, generates a variety of phenolic acids with antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and neuroactive properties. The compounds can influence endothelial function, insulin sensitivity, and even brain function via the gut-brain axis. Then there's circadian and neuroendocrine effects. Beyond caffeine's direct central effects, microbiome-active coffee components may modulate host circadian biology and HPA axis signaling indirectly through microbial metabolites. This could have implications for mood, sleep, and stress resilience when timing, dose, and individual sensitivity are taken into account. So how should you talk to your patients about coffee? First of all, you could pronounce it like you come from Jersey or New York and say coffee, or you could say it like you come from around here and say coffee. Anyway, for integrative and functional medicine practitioners, the emerging science supports a more confident, nuanced position. For many individuals, coffee can reasonably be viewed as a microbiome active, metabolically supportive plant beverage, provided it is used judiciously and individualized. When I was in school, we used to tell people to get off caffeine, that if you had any health issues and you had gut issues and you had this, that, or the other thing, caffeine was the devil. We just told everybody to stop having caffeine altogether. Now, there are some people who really can't handle coffee. If I have too much coffee, because I'm a slow metabolizer, I will get heartburn and I will get digestive upset and I'll get headaches. That's why they say individualized. But if I can find a dose of coffee that works for me, it might actually help me. It'll help my microbiome and a bunch of other things. Obviously, you have to individualize no matter what. If somebody drinks coffee and they feel awful, they shouldn't have coffee. I have patients who are like, well, I really should eat broccoli, but every time I eat it, I feel sick. Well, then don't eat it. Doctor, when I do this, it hurts. So don't do that. So even if it's something that's supposedly good for you, if it hurts you in any way, you shouldn't do it. What you do is you frame coffee as one piece of a dietary strategy that also includes polyphenol-rich fruits and vegetables, legumes, whole grains, fermented foods. Also emphasize that coffee's benefits are amplified when it complements rather than compensates for an otherwise healthy diet and lifestyle. So if you're a person you're pounding coffee all morning because you're trying not to eat, that's not a good thing. It doesn't replace a good diet. So then there's the dose, timing, and preparation of coffee. Most cohort data suggests that moderate intake, which is around 2 to 4 cups a day, which I could never do, depending on the cup size and brew strength, of course, is associated with the greatest benefit. Brewing methods that preserve polyphenols, that is filtered or light or medium roast, may be preferable for patients focused on gut and cardiometabolic health. Her patients with insomnia, anxiety, arrhythmias, or HPA axis dysregulation, front-loading coffee earlier in the day and moderating total caffeine load is critical. So have it in the morning and don't have it later in the day, because then otherwise you won't be able to sleep. Then if you have GI disorder, some patients with GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disorder, gastritis, and inflamed belly, irritable bowel syndrome, or functional dyspepsia. Dyspepsia is a sort of a garbage pail word that means your stomach doesn't work right. Your stomach is just icky, achy, burpy, gassy, just dysfunctional. People who have that report symptom flares with coffee. In these cases, you want to test tolerance with small amounts. Different roasts or cold brew often lower in perceived acidity. And I do a lot of cold brew, although depending on the roast, it can have a lot of caffeine in it. But I do love my cold brew, and I will sip. The cold brew tastes really good. I will sip it black with nothing in it. And there are some places that I go that have great roasts that taste great with absolutely nothing in them. And then there are other cold brew roasts that I get that you really need to put something in them, like at least cinnamon, if not creamer, and some kind of sweetener. But if you get a really great roast that has a wonderful flavor profile, it could be a good sipping coffee. And so you can also get low acid coffee that where the acidity has been buffered. And that is something that people who get heartburn from coffee, they will sometimes get that and do well with it. You can get decaffeinated coffee, and it will retain many polyphenol and microbial benefits while reducing the irritant effects for sensitive individuals. Remember, when you get decaffeinated coffee, you want to get Swiss water decaf coffee. You do not want to get non-organic coffee that has been decaffeinated with methylene chloride, because methylene chloride is a toxin, and here you're trying to clean out your liver with the caffeine and the coffee, and then you go and you have methylene chloride. That doesn't work. So it's much better to do Swiss water processed, and they just use water to decaffeinate the coffee, and then you get much less caffeine. A really good decaf coffee will have 99% of the caffeine taken out, and you can still get a lot of the polyphenol and microbial benefits. For patients who have SIBOs, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, inflammatory bowel disease like Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, or severe dysbiosis, their gut flora is really off, coffee should be trialed carefully and in the context of a broader therapeutic plan. You want to watch the coffee vehicle. Many of coffee's benefits are blunted when it's routinely consumed with large amounts of sugar, syrups, or ultra-processed creamers. You want to encourage patients to move towards black coffee or minimally sweetened versions, and when appropriate, pair with protein or healthy fats instead of refined carbohydrates. So for practitioners, coffee is emerging as a legitimate microbiome-modulating functional food. So I've been talking to patients, like when I was in school, we would tell people just to get off caffeine. And then I moderated over the years when I learned about caffeine, that caffeine can actually help athletic performance, that when you get a dose of caffeine on board, you can work harder and you don't feel like you're working as hard. And I found that to be true when I'm on the bike or doing other kinds of exercise. More research came out and showed that regular coffee consumption can help to prevent gallstones, because it is a cholagogue and choleretic. It increases the production and flow of bile. And so it helps the liver to clean out better. And then there came research that showed that it helps to regulate blood sugar, that people with type 2 diabetes would have less symptoms, and it's protective. It helps modulate blood sugar control in people with diabetes and helps prevent diabetes if you're headed there. So all these studies came out. And then, of course, the polyphenols are antioxidants, so they're going to have all kinds of antioxidant effects. But now what they're talking about is how there are parts of coffee that, you know, constituents that encourage the microbiome, which is great. And if you're encouraging a healthy microbiome, that's worth a million points in terms of your general health. So what you're going to get enhanced short-chain fatty acid production, favorable bile acid signaling, polyphenol-derived metabolites, and improved gut barrier function. So you're going to be less likely to have leaky gut. Your gut is going to stick together better, and you're going to get better, less inflamed villi, more absorption of nutrients, and a less inflamed gut altogether. And the microbiome barrier is going to be more intact, and you're going to have nice tight junctions, and you're not going to have leaky gut. Now, coffee can help with all those things. Who knew? Clinically moderate coffee consumption can be endorsed for many adults as part of a comprehensive gut and metabolic health strategy with careful attention to individual tolerance, comorbidities, and preparation methods. So if anybody gets a thing that's worse by drinking coffee, they shouldn't do it, or they should cut back. So if you get headaches or extreme fatigue or migraines or anything like that, then you have to either work on the dose, and the dose may be none for some people, and the dose may be a little bit for some people. I'm not sure what mine is. Mine is certainly not a lot. Mine is somewhere between none and not too much. And I do better with caffeine on days that I get cardio exercise. I metabolize it better and faster. But I haven't done a genetic test to find out what my CYP1A2 status is. And I'm thinking I'm going to do it. I have an Ancestry DNA kit. I need to do that. And then I'll do the Ancestry DNA kit. I'll get the raw data. And then I'll put it into a biohacking program that will give me my detoxifying and methylation SNPs, my single nucleotide polymorphisms and enzymes, and I'll see what my genetics are. But I will put money on I'm either a slow to medium detoxifier of caffeine. When Ron makes a really good cup of hot coffee in the winter, I'll say, hey, I'll have some. I will take a cup, and I literally will put, I'll barely cover the bottom of the cup. So I'll be drinking maybe an eighth of an ounce of coffee. I'll put a little bit of organic sugar in it, and I'll drink that, maybe dump some cinnamon into it, drink that. Then I come downstairs, and I'm extremely entertaining. So that's why I'm thinking I'm a slow metabolizer. Shout out to Shane, the founder of Mudwater, because he is a slow metabolizer. He did his 23andMe and found out that he's a slow metabolizer of CYP1A2. So I'm going to find out what I am. And if I do Ron, we're going to find out he's a fast metabolizer because he can drink coffee and go to sleep. I can't do that. I do have, I think I do induce my CYP1A2, that if I have a little bit of caffeine every day, when you encounter something that is metabolized by an enzyme in your body, you will induce the enzyme. The liver will see that you are putting caffeine into your body, and it will produce more CYP1A2. So even if you're not a fast metabolizer, you'll have more of the enzyme around, and you'll break it down a little bit better. And then if you go off caffeine, then your CYP1A2 production goes down. Then when you have some again, you're off the charts. So that's not, it's really the best thing to do with caffeine, especially if you're a slow metabolizer, is keep your dose steady. Have some or have none, but keep it steady. And if you go up and down, unless your liver is functioning really, really well, if you go up and down, you're going to have some symptoms from that. I find that I am tolerating caffeine better since I have been treating Lyme disease. And in treating Lyme disease, I'm not just taking herbs to kill Lyme and antibiotics. I'm taking lots of good probiotic, and I'm taking chlorella and spirulina and other things with polyphenols. I'm taking cordyceps. A lot of antioxidants are going in. So there's a lot of detoxification and healing going in. And some days I do have the mud water, which has all the functional mushrooms in it. I don't have it every day, but I do have lion's mane every day. And I'm going to have amla. I have amla every day. And amla is a great Ayurvedic adaptogen that also helps to lower cholesterol in your blood. And it's a great antioxidant. And one of the ways that it helps to lower cholesterol is because it is an antioxidant. So your body is less interested in repairing stuff if there's nothing to repair. But amla also increases LDL receptors on your liver. So it helps to pull cholesterol out of circulation. So I'm taking a lot of stuff that, I'm just focusing. I'm just dialing a lot of health things because I had symptoms that seemed to be a flare of Lyme disease, either a flare or a new bite. I don't know which it was because I never saw a rash. And if you're like, I don't have Lyme disease, I don't have a rash. No. So one of the stats, I was at the CNPA conference, 5 or 10 years ago, and somebody lectured on Lyme, and she said 30% of cases get a rash when they get a tick bite. Only 30%. Remember that the Lyme spirochete loves to eat collagen. And if the spirochetes get in, because, you know, the tick blows out the spirochetes into your bloodstream, and they don't hang around right at the site of the bite, they go other places, you're not going to get the rash. And that happens most of the time. She said 30%, and I'm reading Bill Rawls, he said the same thing. 30% of the time, you will see an erythema migrans rash. So just because you didn't have a rash doesn't mean you have don't have Lyme disease. All right. So interesting. So coffee may become a more deliberate tool in the integrative practitioner's toolkit to treat the terrain by nourishing the microbial partners that help define our health. That's very interesting. Rock and roll. Okay. So that's coffee in the microbiome. All right. Did you know that if you have physiological stress, it can cause cognitive deficits and cognitive decline? I know, shocking, hey? So you get faster cognitive decline if you have cumulative physiological stress. Okay, so if you have higher cumulative physiological stress that's reflected in salivary cortisol, it's associated with faster cognitive decline. Older adults with high cumulative cortisol exposure had worse composite global cognition scores over time. And this was a study from the Rush University Medical Center in Chicago at the Alzheimer's. It was presented at the Alzheimer's Association and published in JAMA Network Open. There was a moderate level of intraday cortisol variability that was associated with slower cognitive decline. And black and white patients had different cortisol profiles at baseline, but associations between cortisol and cognitive decline were similar across racial groups. Our study suggests how cortisol fluctuates across the day may provide important insights into cognitive aging. And the doctor that headed the study was Eng. We examined five complementary indices, capturing three key physiological dimensions of daily cortisol regulation: intraday variability, cumulative daily exposure, diurnal change, rather than relying on a single cortisol measure. They found that different dimensions showed distinct relationships with cognitive aging, which suggests that different aspects of stress physiology may provide complementary insights. Cortisol follows a circadian rhythm with a sharp post-awakening rise and a gradual decline across the day. It crosses the blood-brain barrier and binds receptors in regions critical for cognition. Changes in the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis activity have been implicated in cognitive aging, that Eng and Dahl colleagues noted. It's not clear how prospective associations between cortisol and cognitive outcomes may differ by race. The researchers found almost 4,000 people in the Chicago Health and Aging Project for up to 11 years. The cohort included about 2,500 Black and 1,400 white participants, and the mean age was 77. Participants provided three salivary cortisol samples across a single day, waking, afternoon, and bedtime, and had repeated cognitive assessments. A major strength of the study is the scale and diversity. They studied nearly 4,000 community-dwelling older adults, including more than 60% women and more than 60% Black participants, making this one of the largest and most racially diverse population-based studies of salivary cortisol and cognitive aging. All baseline cortisol indices were associated with cross-section cognitive performance, although Black participants had distinct baseline diurnal cortisol profiles, including a more blunted diurnal rhythm. The associations between cortisol indices and cognitive outcomes were broadly similar across Black and white participants. This suggests that while patterns of diurnal cortisol, that means during the day, may differ between populations, the relationships with cognitive aging may be broadly consistent. Further research is needed to better understand those factors with the baseline differences. There's no significant association between cortisol and incident Alzheimer's disease over the follow-up period. That likely reflects several factors, which includes the substantially smaller subset with actual adjudicated Alzheimer's, the relatively small number of incident cases, and the shorter follow-up relative to the long preclinical course of Alzheimer's. An alternative, which is not mutually exclusive interpretation, is that alterations in diurnal cortisol patterning may be more informative as early physiological indicators of neurocognitive aging than of shorter-term clinical Alzheimer's disease. The findings were based on a single day of cortisol sampling. Multi-day sampling may improve reliability of within-person variability and show longer-term HPA axis dynamics, but a single-day protocol over multiple time points is commonly used in large epidemiological studies. The study did not measure perceived stress. As stress-related health challenges have become increasingly important public health concerns, our findings reinforce the need to better understand how different aspects of stress physiology influence brain health over time. Because salivary cortisol is non-invasive, really easy to do, you have to spit in a tube, it's relatively inexpensive and feasible to collect repeatedly outside clinical settings. That's the other thing. When you do salivary cortisol, nobody has to help you get the sample. It's not like a blood draw. It's very nice. When you do spit, and also if you do urine, the patient can collect their samples themselves. It's nice. So it represents a promising research tool for large-scale population studies investigating stress biology, brain health, and aging. So that's very nice. So what do we know that you get if you're stressed? You're going to have faster cognitive decline. So when you have a lot of cortisol, when you have excessive cortisol around, what do we say about cortisol? Cortisol's job is to run around your body, find stuff to break down, turn it into sugar so you can run away from the bear. That's what cortisol does. So cortisol is what we call a catabolic hormone, and anything that does catabolism breaks tissue down. So cortisol raises your blood sugar. This is not a bad thing if you're trying to do a weightlifting routine, or if you're trying to ride your bike, or you're trying to think, or you're trying to exercise. But if you're in a high cortisol state all day, even when you're sitting still, you're going to have more cortisol on board. Cortisol is going to run around and break down tissue in your body, and you're going to have high blood sugar. If you have high blood sugar leads to inflammation because that raises your insulin. Insulin's going to try to get that extra sugar into your cells. When it can't, it's going to send the extra sugar into fat storage, and insulin promotes various kinds of inflammatory compounds. So you wind up having more inflammation. So when you have increased cortisol, you have increased inflammation. So if you have increased inflammation in your brain, oops, so you're going to have neurodegeneration in your brain. You have neurodegeneration in your brain, you have cognitive decline. And that's not Alzheimer's disease. That's just neurodegeneration from oxidative stress. That's what it is. So how do you help that? That would be why to work on decreasing stress, however you can do it, decreasing your overall cortisol throughout the day. Like, you don't want to be sitting in a cortisol bath all day. You want to have times of day where you're chilling out, relaxing, and you're not. So, how do you reduce cortisol? You do less stuff. You do deep breathing. You do restorative activities like yin and restorative yoga, like tai chi, like leisure walks in nature, like sitting outside in nature, doing crafts, things that are gentle, things that access the ventral vagus nerve. You can biohack and use vagus nerve stimulators as long as you don't have hardware in your neck, and or as long as you don't have a heart arrhythmia or a pacemaker, something that controls your heart arrhythmia. So those are possibilities. There's all kinds of little things you can do, all kinds of ways to interact with the earlobe and around the ear, because the ventral vagus nerve has branches that go right through that part of your body. And so you can press on the tragus, that little bit of tissue in the front of your earlobe. You can press on the spot just above the ear canal. That is a branch of the ventral vagus nerve. You can pull on your earlobe. You can rub behind your ear over the mastoid process, which is that bump behind your ear. And that is where the SCM muscle attaches, because it's the sternocleidomastoid. Sterno, your sternum. Clido, your collarbone. And mastoid is that bump behind your ear that's part of your skull. And that's called the mastoid process. So there's a muscle that's job is to turn your neck and to move your neck. And there's branches of the vagus nerve along there, as well as lymphatics, by the way. So those are ways to access the ventral vagus nerve. When you access the ventral vagus nerve, you calm cortisol. You can take herbs. There are herbs that can calm cortisol. Ashwagandha, nervines, chamomile, cordyceps. Well, cordyceps will modulate your cortisol. Rhodiola, So there's lots of herbs that moderate your cortisol and give you better cortisol function and just make your adrenals function better. So there's all that kinds of things you can do to reduce stress. If you have a psychological thing going on, there's something in your life that's upsetting or stressful, getting counseling to help to deal with that, or getting strategies to help to deal with whatever stressor there is in your life, that can help too. Prayer, meditation, stuff like that. All of these things can help to decrease your general cortisol burden. There's compounds that, like, things you can take in the evening that have ashwagandha in them, and also magnolia. Magnolia is another herb. There's a species of magnolia that is calming to cortisol that we give out. And also phosphatidylserine. Phosphatidylserine is a phospholipid that's part of cell membranes that also tends to calm cortisol. So those are things that can be helpful. All right. So now let's talk about vitamin C and cancer prevention. Who knew vitamin C can help to prevent cancer? There's a new study. I can't believe this is a new study. We were studying vitamin C as one of the things that can help with cancer prevention and treatment when I was in school. When was I in school? 1991 to 1995. Oy vey. All right, but this is a new study. This article was published by the University of Waterloo. It came out on July 17th, 2026. And there's a new study from the University of Waterloo that talks about vitamin C and cancer prevention. So the new research examines how antioxidants may influence the risk of cancers linked to digestion. Vitamin C may do more than just support your immune system. It could also help block chemical reactions in the stomach that are linked to cancer risk. There's new mathematical modeling from the University of Waterloo that suggests the vitamin may help explain why decades of research on nitrates, nitrites, and cancer have produced conflicting results. Nitrates and nitrites are common in the North American diet, appearing in cured meats as well as in fruits and vegetables grown in polluted soil or water. Although those compounds can play useful roles in neurological and cardiovascular health, they can react in the stomach through a process called nitrosation. So you make nitrosamines, creating substances that many scientists suspect may contribute to cancer development. The new study indicates that vitamin C could interfere with this process, potentially reducing the formation of harmful compounds after a meal. Since at least the 90s, researchers have been studying the link between cancer and these compounds with conflicting results. Gordon McNichol said this. He's a postdoctoral researcher in applied mathematics and the first author of the study. The work suggests that the presence of dietary vitamin C may help explain these inconsistencies. Vitamin C may interrupt nitrosation. So to trace the reactions through digestion, the researchers created a mathematical model representing the salivary gland, stomach, small intestine, and plasma. They then simulated how nitrates and nitrites travel through the body and change over time. The results suggested consuming vitamin C alongside nitrates may reduce the formation of potentially harmful compounds. Leafy vegetables such as spinach naturally contain both vitamin C and nitrate, and the model indicated that this combination could lower cancer risk. The simulations also suggested that taking a vitamin C supplement after each meal could moderately reduce the formation of nitrosation products associated with cancer risk from dietary nitrates and nitrates, including those found in bacon and salami. So if you're having an English breakfast, you know, bacon, egg, sausage, fried bread, and tomato, the tomato has vitamin C in it. You could have some citrus with it, or a kiwi, and you'll get your vitamin C as well. So the model guides future experiments. The researchers hope the findings will help shape future clinical and laboratory studies of nutrition and cancer risk. The work provides a mechanistic roadmap for future clinical and laboratory studies by identifying the key interacting drivers of the potentially harmful chemical reactions, including nitrite exposure, antioxidant intake, meal timing, gastric conditions as a condition of your stomach, and oral microbiome activity. That's the microbiome, the gut flora, or the flora in your mouth. That's what that means. And so the model can help research design more targeted experiments and interventions, focusing on when and in whom nitrosation is likely to occur. So the study is vitamin C is a nitrosation inhibitor, a modeling study across dietary patterns and water quality by Gordon McNichol et al. Fascinating. So the deal is you're going to get nitrates and nitrites. Now, if you eat a nitrate or nitrite in food, like in a beet, you don't have to worry about it because there's the antioxidant profile of beets is really high. But if you're having hot dogs are going to have nitrates and nitrites in them. And so are cured meats. So if you like your cured sausage or, you know, you like cold cuts have nitrates and nitrites in them. And even if they don't have added nitrates and nitrites, they probably have some naturally occurring ones. And so if you're going to have a sandwich with cold cuts on it, you may want to have some vitamin C along with your meal. So throwing a bunch of tomatoes on it, especially this time of year when the tomatoes are fresh and they're really good, your tomatoes are going to help you to get vitamin C. And the vitamin C is going to help to prevent the nitrosation. The other thing you can do is if you're eating any kind of cured meat or any kind of meat that can have nitrates in it, you marinate it and you put something in the marinade that has vitamin C, like lemon, lime, orange, anything like that. If I don't know that there's vitamin C, there may be vitamin C in sauerkraut. There probably is. I'm not 100% sure, but that's something you can add too. But if you have leafy greens, if you have a salad with your hot dogs, that's the thing. If you're having a sandwich, because that's how people usually eat their cured meats that have nitrates in them, they have sandwiches. So make sure you're having something with vitamin C in it. And you know, having lettuce, especially a deep leafy green lettuce, as well as tomato on your sandwich is going to help you. If you want to squeeze some lemon or lime on your sandwich, you can do that. If you don't want that flavor profile, that's okay. But perhaps you could have some fruit along with your meal. Any of your berries, strawberries, cherries, raspberries, blackberries, of course, any citrus, apples, kiwi fruit, they all have vitamin C in them, black currants. And in Britain, they are big blackcurrant consumers because it's easy to grow there. They don't, you know, citrus doesn't grow well in Britain. You would have to grow it in a greenhouse because it's just too cold for most of the year. So, you know, when we get halos and other, you know, small cuties and other small clementine oranges, they're coming from places like, now they're coming from the Mediterranean usually. They're coming from Morocco, Spain, Morocco and Spain, and I'm not sure where else, but definitely Morocco and Spain, depending on the time of year. And I think they may grow them in California as well, but definitely you'll see when you get your cuties in the winter, they're coming from overseas, from Morocco and Spain. And they don't grow, that's why you have the term limeys, because they figured out that, you know, when the British sailors years and years ago, hundreds of years ago, were getting scurvy, they figured out that if they fed them limes, they didn't get scurvy. So, but the problem is that limes don't grow well in Britain unless you grow them in a greenhouse. So they have to get them. Thing is, if you're in Britain, you're not that far from a country that does grow citrus well. The south of Spain definitely can grow citrus because it's right on the Mediterranean. I'm not sure about the south of France, but definitely the south of Spain. The south of Spain is even with North Carolina. But it has more of a, some of it has a desert-like climate and some of it has a Mediterranean climate. And then, of course, the North African region, so Morocco and Algeria and Tunisia, Tanzania, places like that, they may be able to get produce from there as well. Definitely Morocco, because I know we get Moroccan cuties in big wine, Moroccan clementines of some brand at our local grocery store. So if you're going to go ahead and eat cold cuts, stuff with nitrates in it, then make sure you have lettuce and tomato and or some kind of a citrus fruit that has a lot of vitamin C. By the way, peppers also, you could put peppers on your sandwich. Peppers also have a lot of vitamin C in them. So the thing is, it's not a good idea to just eat meat and not eat any vegetables. Unless you're on the carnivore diet and that's working for you, then you could do that, I suppose. But even people on the carnivore diet will eat small amounts of fermented vegetables. Not everybody does. Everybody's different. But if you're an omnivore, have some vitamin C-bearing foods with your nitrate-bearing foods. Okay. So there you go. It's very interesting. All right. Here is something about mast cells and IBS. So mast cells and irritable bowel syndrome. So if you have a stuffy nose from allergies, it may make your IBS worse. So if you have seasonal allergies, you're going to be familiar with symptoms such as a stuffed up nose, which is called rhinitis, and itchy eyes. And if you also have irritable bowel syndrome, you may notice that your GI symptoms worsen during allergy season. So there's research that suggests a causal link between IBS and atopic allergies, including allergic rhinitis. So irritable bowel syndrome is a functional gastrointestinal disorder. That is, if they were to go in and take samples of your small intestine, they would not see any levels of inflammation. The cells would be normal. There's no inflammation noted. And the problem is, it's so that's when you don't see actual inflammation, then you call it a functional disorder, because it's about the function. It's not about inflammation. And it comes from problems with how the brain and the gut work together. And the symptoms you get, people with irritable bowel know what this is. You get diarrhea, cramping, abdominal pain, constipation, bloating, gas. And it's controversial. There's a subgroup of IBS that's referred to by some researchers as atopic irritable bowel syndrome. People who are thought to have atopic irritable bowel syndrome have both IBS symptoms and allergic symptoms. The allergic symptoms may include a stuffy nose and itchy eyes. They may also include hives and other allergic skin manifestations. Common IBS symptoms associated with allergic rhinitis are abdominal pain, diarrhea, and gastric discomfort. Gastric discomfort means from the stomach. So rhinitis is caused by common triggers like pollen, dust mites, cockroaches, pet dander, and mold. Aeroallergens are microscopic particles that reach the respiratory tract through inhalation. They can also reach the GI tract through ingestion. If you're allergic to those or other substances, your immune system will overreact by releasing histamine. And when you come in contact with them, that causes symptoms like nasal congestion, a stuffy nose, a runny nose, sneezing, itchy or swollen eyes, sinus pain, coughing, and itchy or sore throat from post-nasal drip, wheezing, and difficulty breathing. Is there a connection between IBS and a stuffy nose? The connection between IBS, I used to see it in Newfoundland. Everybody had lots and lots of people, because they were genetically homogeneous. Lots and lots of people, they were always getting sinus infections and they were always getting irritable bowel syndrome, and they could have both. And when they had IBS, it tended to be constipation up there. They tended not to go the other way. I would have people who didn't poop for a month. It was amazing. So the connection between IBS allergies and allergic symptoms is not completely understood. The role of mast cells, which release histamine, may be a factor. Mast cells are a type of white blood cell found throughout the body in connective tissue. Most mast cells are located under the skin, also found in the intestines. And mast cells, doesn't say that here, but they are derived from cell. They are a blood cell. They're initially a blood cells, and they are made in the bone marrow, called an eosinophil. When eosinophils leave the blood tissue and leave your actual blood and then go into your tissues, then they are called mast cells. And they do the same thing in your blood that they do in the tissue, which is they have eosin. They're called eosinophils because they stain red with red eosin dye, and they have granules in them that when they degranulate, they release histamine. So they can do that in your blood and they can do that in your tissues. They do it when they're in the blood, they're eosinophils. When they are into the tissues, they are now mast cells. So when mast cells detect an allergic substance, they release histamine, which triggers a cascade of symptoms, including a stuffy nose. In the GI tract, mast cells can trigger IBS symptoms when you eat or drink something you're allergic to. They may also react to aeroallergens that reach the GI tract through ingestion. It's not known whether allergies worsen IBS or whether IBS worsens allergies. However, several studies have found that a significant percentage of people have both conditions. There was a study in 2018 that found an association between allergic symptoms such as hives and allergic rhinitis with severe IBSD. And a 2020 clinical review found that children with allergies were more likely to have IBS as adults. An older the 2008 study found that adults with allergic symptoms reported a higher incidence of IBS. Based on their findings, the researchers of the study proposed the establishment of atopic IBS subgroup. So how do you treat IBS and allergic rhinitis? If you have both IBS and allergic rhinitis, your conditions may be treated with different strategies and medications. Your doctor may recommend identifying and eliminating your triggers for both conditions. For hay fever, that may include staying indoors when pollen counts are high, using a vacuum cleaner with a HEPA filter. For IBS, this may mean eliminating IBS trigger foods such as gluten, dairy, and FODMAPs. Treatments for hay fever include over-the-counter medications like antihistamines and decongestants, nasal saline irrigation to treat a stuffy nose, steroid nasal sprays, eye drops for itching eyes, and allergy shots. Treatments for IBS include over-the-counter medications, antidiarrheals, laxatives, and fiber supplements, anticholinergic medications like dicyclamine for bowel spasms, tricyclic antidepressants, that would be like your nortriptyline and your amitriptyline. Yes. IBS prescription drugs like linaclotide, which is for really for constipation. So IBS symptoms and hay fever are connected, though the exact causes and reasons remain unclear. Some research indicates a connection between allergies and IBS. People with allergic symptoms like a stuffy nose or hives may also have IBS symptoms. It's not known yet whether either of these conditions worsens the other. Both IBS and hay fever can be treated with at-home remedies, lifestyle alterations, and prescription medications. So this is very interesting because people can have both IBS and hay fever, and that they can be related to each other. That you're having if you're having an IBS flare, you may be also having an allergic rhinitis flare, and that your IBS symptoms may get worse during hay fever season. So what you do is I would just treat both. And one of the things I would do is I would give things that are mast cell stabilizers, because mast cells are the star of this show, and the mast cells are very sensitive. So what you want to do, remember Bill Rawls is talking about system disruptors for Lyme disease. So what you want to do is stop the things that are disrupting the system. One of the things, and because it's the IBS is a gut brain thing, one of the things you want to do is treat the brain. So if somebody has stress and anxiety, that's going to make their IBS symptoms worse and maybe their hay fever symptoms worse. So you treat the stress. You help the person to do stress reduction, whatever that looks like for them, helping to work on stressful situations that are in their lives, giving, you know, useful advice that can help with that. And also giving, things that are de-stressors that have nothing to do with the stressful situation. There's your meditation, your leisure walks in nature, your gentle exercise, your yoga, your Tai Chi, your sitting outside, just being with nature, doing your crafts or prayer, whatever your de-stressor is, that's going to help you with your gut function and also your nasal function. But in terms of supplements, what we usually do for IBS is we make sure you have a good microbiome. So we try to find a probiotic that will work for you. If you have a lot of cramps and spasms, we might give magnesium to calm that down. And we might also offer peppermint and spearmint oil. We might also offer things like deglycyrrhizin and licorice, things that are soothing to the digestive system, like aloe and slippery elm. And ginger is a great digestive anti-inflammatory. And then we would try to figure out if there are foods that you regularly eat that don't work for you. So we might do some level of food intolerance testing. And the big bullies, gluten, dairy, sugar, caffeine, alcohol, processed food. We talk about those things, and we might also do testing that helps to figure out if there are foods that you're eating that don't work for you. But there are supplements that are soothing to the digestive system, and then there are supplements that help with histamine and are mast cell stabilizers. So quercetin is a good one, and its metabolite isoquercetrin, that can be really calming to histamine. If you tend to make a lot of histamine when you eat various foods, we might give you DAO. If you have low DAO, diamino oxidase, we might give you diamino oxidase supplements or supplements that help to increase your DAO. Vitamin C is a great mast cell stabilizer, so that's one of the things we might offer as well. and nettle leaf more than nettle root. Nettle leaf is good. It's nettle leaf is like one of nature's multivitamins. It has a lot of vitamins and minerals, and it has compounds in it that stabilize quercetin, or stabilize mast cells. So it's really good for you that way. So nettle tea, I drink nettle tea every day, and I have some nettle tea every day. I also take vitamin C pills every day, and I also eat fruit every day. So my vitamin C status is probably pretty good. And since I've been treating Lyme disease, I find that my gut is working very well, to the point where I can eat a bit of dairy and be okay. Now I'm not going to go eating dairy all the time. Like, I probably would not eat a cheese pizza, a pizza with real cheese on it. But I get very special cheese that's made from raw milk, and I have a very little bit of it on my salad, and that's all I have. If I want to sprinkle cheese for real on like a burrito or something, I'm using the non-dairy cheese. Or if I'm having a slice of cheese on a sandwich, I'm using the non-dairy cheese. But, and I do, I have non-dairy Parmesan cheese too, which is, it has lactic acid in it, and it's fermented. It tastes very good. Vitamin C, quercetin, isoquercetin, DAO, and also there's a quail egg extract that is helpful for allergies too. And so when people have IBS, you can treat their mast cell stuff. If people have mast cell activation issues, they also tend to get very anxious. So nervines in general would be herbs that I would use to help with this if that was appropriate. So I would use things like oat straw and nettle and oat straw and linden and lavender, linden, chamomile. Those are other great nervine herbs. And then, you know, like I said, you work with stress reduction. So I think that's enough for today. That was exciting. We had my fire alarm went off while I was sitting here, but it stopped. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS stores and WHUS.org. Thanks for listening.